Welcome back. It is Swing Pass. I'm Adam Ruffner. That is Cameron Brock. We are here on March 26th recording tonight, and we are 1 month away from the start of the 2024 UFA season. Cannot come soon enough. Cam, I know you're probably even more excited than I am getting a chance to get back on the field, although Indy doesn't get their first game of the season until week three. I know you're going to be dying just looking at score reports and results over the first 2 weeks, just chomping at the bit. But we are on the precipice of the regular season. We've got just a few more weeks of previews. First up, we've got a little bit of laundry to clean up from the last episode and some things I think we missed. And then we're going to get into some discussion about the best backfield throwing talent in the league, as well as some teams we think are on the precipice of becoming into that elite tier, that Pantheon top four team as far as throwing excellence in the pro level. But again, first, we're going to get to a couple of, again, like news items that we sort of, I think, omitted from our last episode, or a correction or two. First up, let's start with Team Canada announcements. Now, Team Canada, unlike Team USA, unveiled their Worlds rosters at the end of 2023, and I had kind of honestly forgotten about that last week when we were talking all about the Team USA Worlds roster announcements and all of the UFA athletes participating in that, but I was definitely remiss to forget our Canadian brothers up north and the 10 UFA athletes that are rostered on teams throughout the league that did make Worlds rosters, and I want to read those off to you here and now. Starting and going alphabetically with Brandon Adibe out of Toronto, Jacob Brissett out of Montreal, Luc Comere out of Toronto, Raphael Lalonde-Landry out of Montreal, Landon Lavie out of Portland. Excuse me, I know I'm butchering a couple of these. Getting tongue-tied. Keith McRae out of Toronto, Quinn Snyder representing the Minnesota Windchill, and also Oscar Stonehouse representing Toronto as well. Again, 10 UFA rostered athletes competing for Team Canada later on in 2024. I believe that's at the end of August and into the first week of September is when those games will be played. Also, kind of connecting to the Toronto Rush, I mentioned last week the Lewis brothers of Wilkie and James as being on the 2024 roster. That was not the case. That was a mistake on my part. I'm sorry. I overlooked the roster too quickly. They will not be currently rostered heading into the season. That will be a massive loss for Toronto's offense. Two of the best goal scorers in the East Division and two of the bigger framed receivers in the league gone from the roster. So it will be interesting to see how Toronto handles that loss. And then finally, we had mentioned last week that Salt Lake had kind of won the offseason in a way by returning a majority of their roster, seeking stability after being runner-up finishes to New York last year. And we failed to mention, actually, the re-signing of one of their biggest players during the 2022 season, the return of a hometown hero, Joe Merrill, coming back to the Shred in 2024. I had forgotten, honestly, how much he had blazed through his first season with the Shred. In 2022, in 13 games, that man racked up 52 goals, 12 blocks, and over 3,600 receiving yards. That adds up to 4 goals and 280 receiving yards per game. Again, as Salt Lake made the West Division Championship that year. Merrill, of course, now returning after a season in DC playing defense. Remains to be seen if he's going to slot right back in on offense. I feel like that's kind of where he most naturally lines up. He has a ton of familiarity, with a lot of the throwers on that team, in particular Jordan Kerr and him. Had a certain kind of synergy going on in 2022. Cam, I need to bring you in here. What do you think about Merrill? I mean, he kind of tracks as one of the more pure goal scorers, you obviously being the king of that in this league. What do you like about Merrill and him coming back to the Salt Lake team in 2024?
Well, first off, I just figured there was only room in town for one Merrill, so that they just shipped him off to DC. I thought that he was just going to stay there.
And just to up Cam's comment here, Bryce Merrill, the reigning coach of the year, and Joe Merrill, not related, I have found out. That is sort of surprising, given the amount of siblings and relatives elsewhere on the Shred roster. I don't think they're adding another Jorgensen this year, or at least they haven't cloned one yet, but we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. I actually made the joke to a teammate of mine, Colin Ringwood, about the Jorgensens. I think he actually sent out in one of the player chatters, I don't know how many Jorgensens there are on Salt Lake Shred, but I'm too afraid to ask at this point. I think the UFA actually quote tweeted it and like sent it.
Well,
out.
Salt Lake actually made a little video last year where they even had like Grant Lindsay and Jordan Kerr dressing up in Jorgensen jerseys. I think they had Will Selfridge too, and just being like, there's eight now. We have eight Jorgensens.
Yeah. Well, I made the joke. I was like, there's got to be something mythical going on here. Like, they can't all be from the same family. And we found out that there is an old vampire movie where the vampire's name is Jorga. So we were like, this is they're Jorga's sons. This is how this happened.
We are like 3 minutes into this episode, and we're already on vampires. I mean, this has got to be record time for getting off track, but I got to say, I admire it. I like it. But
this is what happens when you add me to the podcast. Things are going to go off rails. But getting back to the point, Joe Merrill was great.
Don't do that.
I think one of the reasons we kind of can forget how great he was as a goal scorer, and not even just a goal scorer, but I mean, he completed 97% of his passes. He had 11 blocks during the regular season and in 11 games playing primarily offense, like pretty insane numbers. And we can forget about it because Jordan Kerr had a season that year that was kind of so legendary almost that it kind of overshadowed the great work that Joe Merrill was doing. But when you looked at the assist numbers from Jordan Kerr, where were a lot of those going to? They were going to Joe Merrill. And Joe Merrill didn't have the same role last year in DC. He wasn't as, you know, primary of an option. And he wasn't playing as many offensive points. So he took a completely different approach with DC, only played 5 offensive points the whole season compared to 239 when he was with Salt Lake. So, I mean, you're talking about a guy who he can definitely do it on both sides of the disc, had 10 blocks last year in 8 games with DC. Getting him back to Salt Lake, I'm going to give you a little bit of grace. I don't take any blame for this because, like, this is just me. I just show up for the pod and I do my best. But, you know, like, but it was hard. Like, for those that don't know, like, when we're looking over the rosters, what we had was essentially a huge spreadsheet where people were just putting their rosters in. And some people were great about some teams put them in and we had a lot of time to look at them. And some we were kind of looking at literally like it felt like almost hours beforehand because they were put in so late. No comparison to the year before. And looking at Salt Lake's roster, we basically just saw a lot of the same names. Like, okay, it looks like it's just kind of the same team. And then there was the one name that we probably should have paid attention to, which was Joe Merrill.
He fits in so naturally there. I mean, look at it. He just fits right in that Zion mountain landscape.
That's because he's built.
I know. I know. I'm so excited for the double gun celebrations to return to that stadium. They actually continued. They started it in their inaugural season because of Joe Merrill. They had a fan cam thing at their stadium where they would do the, I mean, a lot of sports do this, but they would do it after Joe Merrill doing the double gun flex, and they would cut around to like kids and stuff doing it, grandmas. But they continued that tradition in 2023, so now it's going to be a homecoming for the Merrill Gun Show to Salt Lake. I don't know if that's family-friendly necessarily. Might have to rebrand that a little bit, but I don't know. I'm signing up for some tickets to the Merrill Gun Show this season. I mean, that guy, you know, again, sort of has now had 2 seasons where I think some of his work has gone overlooked. He was a part of that Joe Richards and Joe Merrill J&J Roofing Company connection on the DC Breeze in 2021. He goes back home to the Salt Lake Shred in 2022, is a 50-goal scorer for them, helps them to double-digit wins in a West Division championship game. Then in 2023, he goes back on his, I don't even know what it is, like a student permit to DC or something, plays for the Breeze, basically as an anchor point of their D-line a lot of times, spends almost exclusive time there. Now in 2024, it figures he's going to go back to the Shred again, tenure 2, and just reprise his role as one of the best receivers in the West Division, if not the league. I just think, you know, Merrill, for his selflessness, for his team-first attitude, he's an amazing individual athlete. But where he really excels is just plugging back in and being like not only a locker room guy, a weight room guy, an off the field guy. I mean, you talk to players about playing with Joe Merrill and just like smiles pop in their faces and they're like, ah, Joe, man, like that dude's just good vibes to be around. And I think that Salt Lake could have used somebody like that in the finals against New York. It kind of felt like they might have lacked that just go get 'em totem that Merrill has been in that community for so many of the past few years. And so I'm really excited to see him back in this role, to see where they utilize him, where he can get most play. And here's the thing, leads terrifically into a feud in week one in that first Super Series game, because now we get Merrill revenge game possibly. But that's as much for our kind of news and notes at the beginning of this episode. Let's get into the meat of it and talk about throwing. As you may have noticed on the UFA website and social media, there's a bit of a throwing week going on discussing throwers. Daniel Cohen actually published a really great piece talking about five of the newer stats used to analyze throwers earlier today on watchufa.com. Go over and be sure to read that. It's some great, great tables and data and insights into what makes good throwers in different contexts. He talks about huck rate, throws per possession, completions per possession, all kinds of good rate stats that I really think give a good and dynamic overview as to how complex it is to analyze what makes good throwing, quote unquote. Because I think, you know, there's a thousand ways sort of to proverbially skin this cat. But we want to get into specifically on this episode talking about four of the preeminent handler groupings in the league. And obviously we could easily balloon that discussion into probably like 8 or 10 teams. But for the sake of limited bandwidth, time, reality, everything else, we're going to discuss primarily four teams. And I'm going to start alphabetically at the top with one of the teams I have highlighted for their throwing talent, and that's Atlanta. I mean, you look at their ability to balance both precision. They finished top five in the league in team completion rate with being the most dynamic deep attack. And I use dynamic very specifically. Not only are they one of the most volume heavy hucking teams in the league, they've been each of the past three seasons the most successful hucking team in the UFA. They are just tremendous at engaging that deep game. The combination of Austin, Draco Taylor, and Bobby Lay is almost second to none in terms of volume huck rate. And then you add in a player like Christian Olsen, as well as some of the other throwers on that line, and there's just a lot to work with here. They're a little bit undersized, but Cam, I wanted to get your opinion on each of these four teams, and obviously starting with Atlanta. What is it about this throwing group with Lay, Draco, and Christian Olsen that makes this Atlanta offense so formidable?
Yeah, so we've had the opportunity to play Atlanta the last 2 years, and we are going to be playing them again this year. So this is something I can kind of speak to firsthand. The thing, first off, Austin Taylor not only is a great deep thrower, he has to have the quickest release of anybody when they throw deep. Like, you know, you see people throw these big hucks, especially these big backhand hucks, and you usually see like these pretty big windups and they step out really far and then they throw up. But like with Austin Taylor's backhand, it feels like it comes out before you can even recognize what's happening. And I think that's a big key because he's not a very long person. Like, he's not that tall. He doesn't have the length that some really great throwers have. Like, you look at like a Jonathan Nethercutt, right? Like, he's a pretty big dude. Like, he has some length to him. He can easily step around people. And with Austin Taylor, I think probably out of necessity, he has developed this incredibly quick and powerful release. It doesn't hurt that they have guys like Brett Holzmeier and Matt Smith, you know, to chase these hucks down either. I mean, those are obviously some pretty good targets to throw to. But the thing that makes that trio so dangerous is that they are incredibly accurate throwers. Like, we talk about just pure accuracy. Like, I might trust those three more than any other trio in the league of just like, if I were to put a target out on the field, like 30 yards away and said, hit the bullseye, I don't know if there's another trio I would pick to like, just be able to pinpoint, hit a spot on the field than those guys. But the fact that they're pretty, despite the fact that they huck a lot, the reason they're so successful is because they don't necessarily take every single Huck look that they see. They're very good about waiting until they're in a good position to throw with a receiver running into a good spot and a good space. They're not just putting it up because Brett's running deep and Brett's a large man and we're just going to put it up and hope that he comes down with it. Like, the types of Hucks, they're hitting their players in stride out in front of the defense, and they probably do that as well as any throwing tandem in the UFA. You know, the guys in New York are great, right? But, like, I've seen a lot of Jeff Babbitt and Ben Yacht skyballs thrown up. So, like, they're clearly not all just going out and hitting people in stride in front. But I feel like with Atlanta, there's almost like a mantra like that it has to be our guy's catching it or nobody's catching it. And almost like that has to be the baseline for if they're even going to decide to throw it in the first place. Because so often when they put it up deep, it just feels like as a defender, you have no chance at it. You just got to hope they overthrew it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good time to give hats off to that Hustle coaching staff. Obviously, it started a few years ago with Miranda Knowles, but now with Tuba Bench and Jaja at the helm, it just feels like the entire team's understanding of what is a green light is better than any other team in the UFA, kind of by a margin too. Like, their team-wide discipline and engaging that deep ball while still being so effective at it just doesn't really have a peer group right now. And I think that's equal parts coaching as well as obviously the skill of Bobby Lay, Draco. And, you know, I try to bring up Christian Olsen as much as possible because I feel like he's truly perhaps the most underrated player in this league. I mean, there isn't a missing component from his game other than like a maybe hypothetical aspect of size. I mean, when you talk about precision, efficiency, execution, big game moments, clutch factor, tough player, like Olsen just checks every single box. And his ability to constantly sort of be in flux, have a fluid role in any given point, you know, I think Lay and Draco are so kind of anchored in the backfield. Draco will sometimes start more upfield. He might be at the front of the stack to begin a possession, sort of allowing for him to get that first cut look. But those two are pretty anchored to the backfield. Olsen will start in the backfield, but he'll matriculate upfield. He'll get a little bit more dynamic as a receiver, but then he's always seemingly available for that reset, that upline, that tight red zone goal or something. Like, his ability to kind of ball hawk, but on offense, knowing the timing of everyone. I mean, I think it just gives the stage for Lay and Taylor to rip and have almost impunity in their shot selection, so to speak, in engaging these deep balls, where they're, again, the most prolific duo of hucking teammates in the entire UFA. And it's just that kind of like entire organism, the synchronicity of all three elements, again, like, puts them into this pedestal for me. They make it look easy, and yet they don't have some of the flair of some of the other units we'll talk about that have maybe an athlete that's a little bit more dynamic of a playmaker, can go upfield and cycle more. Like, these are all players who kind of stick around the disc, and yet there's zero stickiness to the Hustle offense. There is such good movement between its parts.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned Christian Olsen. He is willing to go downfield a bit more. And the first time we played against him in 2019, I actually thought of him more as like more of a hybrid, you know? I didn't really think of him much as like the backfield guy because he was catching the disc so much more in space upfield. I mean, last year he had 20 goals. I mean, 20 goals is not a small number. You know, that's a lot for somebody who's primarily in the backfield. And that's while completing, you know, 97.5% of his passes. Like, you talked about the efficiency that they have. He can kind of go under the radar somehow. But, I mean, I think that's a credit to Atlanta as a team and just how solid they are top to bottom of their roster. And especially on that O-line, it just feels like they have one of the most stacked O-lines in the league. Like, it doesn't feel like there's a weak link there. Bobby Lay, I do want to give him credit because I felt like he was, in my eyes, a little underwhelming when he first went to Atlanta. It kind of looked like, you know, he came in, there was kind of a lot of fanfare from what he had done in his past years in the UFA, And then when he got to Atlanta, he kind of seemed to feel a little bit lost in the shuffle. I felt like last year he really asserted himself as kind of the player that we all saw him to be, you know, pre-COVID with some of his previous teams. So I do want to give him his flowers because he definitely flipped the thoughts that I had on him. I kind of thought he didn't even belong on that O-line, if I'm being completely honest.
Well, it felt like a redundancy, right? It was sort of like, but they have Draco. Like, they've got the guy who just lets fly whenever he feels like it. Do they really need another? It kind of felt like, are we bringing too much cannons aboard here? We're importing Bobby Lay and Jeremy Langdon. Tuba's on board. Like, half this Atlanta team is Florida castoffs at this point. But no, I
Jakeem Polk, Bradley St. John.
I'm saying there's a large crop of former cannons players on this Hustle team. Are they going to also import some of the, let's say, ill-advised throwing attempts that that team was notorious for? You know, like, all the talent, but man, that team had no sense of what a good green light was versus a not so good one. And yet, to your point, I mean, Bobby Lay in that South Division Championship game we've talked about before, Austin kind of made it into this different, less efficient brawl than Atlanta wanted it to be. And I really felt like it was Bobby Lay's deep throws in the middle part of that game that was a huge part of the stabilizing effort to not get overwhelmed by Austin's playmaking. I mean, when he gets into that zone where he's just almost in a rocking chair throwing the OI bends on both forehand and backhand side, his sort of fade placement on deep shots, I feel like it's second to none. I mean, I kind of feel like he gets lost as far as a trendsetter in this league in particular about the sort of arcing cross field hucks that maybe vertically don't engage as like a hucking stat, but he's using the full width to hit like the back corner from the far sideline. Like that ability, that like horizontal stretching that he does, I think really revealed itself to be the not redundant part. Like, again, like I think before now, I kind of just considered, you know, before the last couple of years and having more advanced stats and educating myself, like I think I thought of hucking as being more binary about just deep shots, a deep shot, a deep shot. But now seeing Draco and Lay play off each other, it's like they allow Taylor a little bit more of that vertical runway, whereas Lay gets a little bit more of the horizontal space to really stretch. And you just see, like your point, Atlanta isn't throwing a lot of contested shots. I mean, I know Halsmeier gets his end of quarter opportunities and Dean Ramsey has some here and there dunk balls too, but like there is a lot of just throwing into space and receivers running onto the disc deep shots for this Atlanta team.
That's what you want. That's the dream, right? You know, I've talked with people a lot before. I was like, can my highlight reel, considering how many times I've scored, isn't very exciting per, you know, per score on a per score basis. You're going to get some pretty boring footage of me scoring goals, which is the way I like it. I don't, you know, making a great play is fun. Like it's great when it happens, but you know what else is great? Just clap catching it and not having to worry about anything, you know? So like, and that seems to be what Atlanta does as well. Probably better than any team in the league is just making sure that when that disc goes deep, it is a clap catch there. It is not contested. And it's their person's going to come down with it or no one is. Like they don't get D'd a lot on those deep shots. Of course, the end of quarter shots, like, you know, those are out of necessity, not by design, right? You just kind of have to throw those up. But I mean, you take those out of the equation and, you're just not giving the defense a lot of opportunities. So who we got next?
Next up on our list, the league leader, two of the last 3 years in team completion percentage. They hold the single season record, the first and second place spots. The DC Breeze. I think there's no surprise here that they would make this list. I mean, their forte, I think, is their both top end throwing talent and just the depth of dynamic throwers that they have. You know, we've talked extensively about this team's strength, as well as their averseness to the long ball. And we'll definitely get into that in this discussion. But as far as kind of listed handlers, I have Andrew Roy, Johnny Malks, Rowan, and then parenthetically because they feel a little bit more like spot starters. Nissen's still wrapping up his college career. Edmonds still bouncing between offense and defense. But Jacques Nissen and Thomas Edmonds obviously deserve some kind of placeholder spot on this list. And then if you really want to get cheeky, you can really bring in how DC uses its continuation throwers. Of course, talk about Cole Jurek, Tyler Monroe, and Jeff Wodach, who are all three of the more talented throwers in the East Division, even if their volume and completion metrics as passers aren't at the top end of the list. But let's kind of stick to the backfield, and in particular, A'Roy Malks, Rowan, and then bringing in Nissen and Edmonds, because I know you need to get back on your Edmonds fanboy chant. I think you dropped the ball recently in some of your discussions about...
Not since we shared... Nope. I'm resigned. I've resigned from the Edmonds fan club.
Let that be a lesson to anybody else that Cam signs up for to head their fan club. He is quick to turn his
coat. I've got my reasons.
He's not in it for long. He's in it for the thrill. That's it.
Yeah, because if there's anything you can tell by looking at my career as a UFA player, I'm clearly not in it for the long haul.
Commitment.
I'm not here for longevity. I'm not here for showing up day in, day out. I'm not here for, you know, the moments where it gets hard and the team's not good and you got to figure out how to turn it around. No, front runner. I'm here for the good times. I'm out for the bad times.
God, there's so many good audio nuggets you just gave me there. I mean, you just said the team's bad. Like, I'm pulling that out, just running it. I've got an AI spend budget somewhere. I'm sure I could figure out Sora. Some other thing, put that behind it, give it back to the Indy Alley Cats social media team.
Can't wait.
No, Bart Scott. Getting back to DC's thrower unit. What is the thing? Obviously, I think precision or like deep bag of throws is where you're going to go first and foremost with a throwing lineup of Malks, Rowe, and A'Roy. But what is the thing that impresses you most about the Breeze when you watch this offense play? Like, is it the quick movement? Is it their ability to kind of almost make long drives seem so feasible? Those are kind of the things that stand out for me, was like, especially last year with the new pulling rules, DC's ability to navigate out of that deep end zone space in their own half was nearly flawless. It felt like you'd have A'Roy probably pick up and they'd just be at half field within like four throws and 10 seconds. But what is it that stands out to you about this Breeze throwing unit on offense when you look at it right away?
Yeah, so you touched on it a little bit. Like, part of it is just that they never look uncomfortable. Like you said, even deep in their own territory and situations where really good players do kind of noticeably look uncomfortable, DC doesn't really ever seem to suffer from that. Also, because they had so many people in and out. Also, like we talked about a lot of times already this year about how their offensive lineup was fluctuating throughout the season, and they were having different people coming in and out, and it just kind of seemed like no matter who they put in there, you know, they're just kind of going to go out there and do their thing. They were going to have their short game. They were going to be moving, dinking and dunking, but, you know, having these drives that are 20-plus throws, keeping the score of the game fairly low because they're just possessing so much on offense. And you mentioned their deep bag of throws, but they don't have a deep throw in their bag. So there is that. I mean, it is so hard to talk about how great a throwers this team is without looking at just the stark reality that they were, what, 17th in the league last year in huck completion percentage, a full, like, for a reference, they were a full 12% behind Atlanta, who was in first. And they were kind of in this mix of teams that were all around like 58%. It is wild, though, because like if you were to ask me to put a group of people out there to just complete passes and no restrictions on like where the passes had to be, I mean, DC's lineup is going to be the lineup I pick. And even though we're mostly focusing on the backfield, you kind of already mentioned some of their downfield players, and they seem to be almost in the same tier of thrower, some of them, as the people who are in the backfield. Johnny Mauchs is one person on that team, though, that does throw a really good deep ball. He did. I know we were talking in the pre-show about how sometimes he kind of will cycle upfield a little bit and then maybe loses the opportunity to make some of those deep throws because he is their best deep thrower, yeah, especially from a volume perspective.
It's just it's kind of the double edge of the sword, right? Like Mauchs has been so much better at engaging upfield, making himself into receiver. He had a career high in goals scored last year and was just visibly more of a presence as far as his he's always been a mobile passer, but his ability to gain yardage and activate and be a little bit more dangerous downfield was, I think, very, very understandably improved last year. But because he was so singularly their deep look specialist, that once he went upfield, it kind of gave away the game that DC wasn't really going to be hucking from their backfield position. DC likes to use Jurek, Wodach, last year's Ben Ort to toss in that long ball from the continuation space. But when it's Aroy and Rowan and even Nissen back there, I mean, they're not really looking to throw anything beyond 25 yards at a time. They love those medium range passes, especially on the break side into space, just sort of throwing onto a pillow for a receiver to go get with no real challenge. But talk about being averse or disciplined in shot selection deep. It feels like unless it was Boxley just running away from people, Tyler Monroe running away from people, they were never pulling that trigger on their huck looks.
Yeah, you know, I think that's kind of a credit to them too, though, because other teams know that they're not really looking to huck the disc. And despite that fact, they're still able to complete all these passes that are shorter over and over again. So even without that real threat, I mentioned to you beforehand when we were thinking about this show and I was trying to rattle my brain. I'm like, what, you know, kind of like you said at the beginning, like, what is a good thrower? It's kind of this nebulous question. Like, it feels like you can go so many different ways with it. And I kind of, in my brain, started to formulate some type of answer, I think, where I basically divided. I had like three categories of like throwers that you have to like game plan for, because that's what I was really thinking about. Like, if you're a really great thrower, it should be the point where like the other team has to actively think about what they're going to do against you. I kind of had these three categories that came up in my mind. I don't even remember the, I think I said, the dual threat, which is kind of what Johnny Mauchs is, right? He's the person who can beat you with his arm, beat you with his legs, as we saw last year, him increasing his goal scoring total to a place he'd never been before. Also being the most consistent hucker on their team. There's the people who are like, I say Pavel is this, they're like the people who just control the offense, where it's like they're the every other, like the disc runs through me, I'm just going to make good decisions the whole way up the field.
I actually think DC might have the best player in the league at that in Andrew Roy over the past 3 years.
Andrew Roy, yeah.
He is the consummate chill it down, complete 50 passes a game, turn it maybe once. I mean, he's just been a robot in the backfield for Minnesota and DC.
He's so frustrating. So frustrating to play against. Like, when he was in Minnesota, his last year there before he went to DC in 2022, like, it was just one of those things where when he had the disc in his hand, you're like, okay, he's going to complete his pass. Like, it's probably not going to be very far downfield. It's not going to be anything flashy, but like, we're not going to get a block on this throw. It's going to be the next throw that we have to try to get a block on. Then when it went back to Aroy, I'm like sitting there thinking, okay, now we got to go another throw where I know we're not going to get a turnover. It's just like, it's so frustrating because he is so good at just finding the next easy pass to continue the motion and keep the offense moving. He does that as well as anyone in the league. He doesn't quite demand the disc as much as someone like a Pavel will, where it's really like, go give me the disc back. Like, I want the disc back right now. But he is somebody who will get a lot of touches, and he is as good as anyone, if not the best in the league, given a high volume. Like, if you told me, you know, that a player on a team was going to have 50 throws, who's most likely to complete all 50 of them, it would be Andrew Roy's probably the very top of my list.
He might have the most impressive pro debut I can think of off the top of my head back in 2021 when he stepped onto the field for Minnesota. Still in college, nothing really known about him at the pro level. His backfield mate that game was Will Brandt, who was, I think, 19 at the time. And they just worked the Madison zone. It was the first game off of the pandemic, first game back for the UFA. And it was as prime time as we could get. I was on my first broadcast with Evan Lepler. We were on DraftKings. Like, talk about a different time 3 years ago. And Roy was the same then as he is now. I mean, I wanted to jump back and look at what his actual game stats were for that game. But he was 70 of 73 against ostensibly like one of the best defenses. Had 5 hockey assists, 2 regular assists, 2 goals, one of which was the equalizer as time expired at the end of regulation that sent him to overtime or Minnesota won. I mean, he took on the greatest volume against a defense that is notorious for game planning and stumping younger throwers, particularly when they're playing at Breeze. And I just remember by like the third or fourth quarter, I was kind of saying the same thing as you guys often did. Obviously, he had 3 throwaways in this. It was his first pro game. Forgive him. But it was sort of like, hey, this kid's going like every other and has made like no mistakes here tonight. And it's just, it's that consistency that he allows, that backbone that I think gives a chance for the development of Malk's going downfield, for Rowan to experiment on defense, for them to choose different throwing lineups because they know at the pivot position, they've got arguably the best distributor in the league. I mean, the other part is that marks are basically nothing to him. I mean, you talk about steady breakthroughs that get the disc into tight spaces, how they should be. Roy, not only for his disc touch, but also his length. I feel like a lot of people really underestimate his size. He's around 6 feet, if not a little bit over, and he gets out and low on those throws. And like you say, it's just kind of unblockable. You have to mentally like check into where the disc is going to be next, because you know A-Roy is just going to complete that throw. And so from that, it's just like everything builds off of that. I mean, again, they led the league in team completion rate last year. They were first in red zone efficiency too. I think that's no secret, again, given their predilection for small ball and the precision in those spaces. But I don't know, anything else about DC's throwing lineup? Do you want to see more Edmonds? Are you anticipating maybe a little bit more Jurek in the backfield? I feel like whenever Jurek also gets a larger throwing volume, he's been really adept at handling that. Maybe we see more Nissen this year. He only played half a season last year. He feels like one of those players whose ceiling could take DC to a new level, especially now without Boxley. It feels like late season Nissen could become a huge factor. Where does your mind go analyzing the Breeze?
So Nissen, I don't think threw a huck in his 6 games or how many he played last year. If I remember, I thought that was like wild to me. Like, especially because you think like college guy coming in, like college guys tend to be a little less disciplined, right? Like, or like those younger guys. I think he was on the U24 Worlds team. Maybe that was good for him to go there and. Maybe, but I don't know.
I mean, he famously started his pro career by, I think, completing every pass in his first 6 games. I think he was 99-99 or something back in 2019 or whatever it was.
They still have, even with the absence of some of the players that won't be there this year, they still have so many viable options for their offense. I do think getting more of Cole Jurek on the field. He is another guy. You talked about how they would get a lot of their hucks from like continuations from their cutters. Cole Jurek's a guy who can do that really well. Thomas Edmonds, a guy who can do that really well. And they can both burn you deep as well. I would love to see them exploit more of that this year, of that ability of some of their cutters downfield to be able to continue with deep shots to other really athletic, fast cutters. So we'll see what that looks like for them this year. I don't think it's much of a stretch to say I expect them to be better in the deep game this year, mostly because it's hard to imagine that they could get worse. I do think Christian Boxley, as great of a player as Boxley is, like he's not a person who's ever like he's not a person we're worried about what he's going to do with this when it's in his hands. It's what we were always worried about. What is he going to do when he doesn't have this in his hands, when he's like just chopping you up downfield, when he's striking deep, when he's just getting these huge unders because he has just made such a great cut out in space. I think if they, depending on who comes in to fill that role, it might be somebody who is a little more dynamic with the disc actually in their hands, and maybe that can lead to a little bit more of a deep game, which I think they do have. I'm on the record very, very loudly as saying they need that if they're going to be able to compete in their division to actually represent their division in championship weekend. So we'll see.
Yeah, and they've got some new receiving talent too, with Elliot Bonnet from the Team France Beach Worlds team that was like the tournament MVP. We'll see his effect deep. Miles Grovic is a rookie this year who I think might deserve a little bit of shine going into the season. Big, lanky athlete. He's been playing on Virginia Vault as kind of one of their main targets and has been at a nationals level in the club scene for a couple of years. He might be able to step in and fill in some of the Orton Boxley production losses and maybe just be a more reliable deep threat. We'll see. We'll see with DC. Of course, they kick off their season again week one against Salt Lake in the first of the 8 Super Series games, which are all available free and live on the league's YouTube channel. We will, of course, preview that more and more as we get further towards the start of the season, and we'll probably talk about it later in the segment because, spoiler alert, Salt Lake is on this throwing list. But before we get to them, we'll get to our penultimate team, last season's champion, 30-game winning streak. Of course, they've got a bedrock of great throwers, and although the stats don't always bear it out as far as the efficiency and everything, I feel like this is still my group that I go to in my head as far as just what I want for my throwing lineup, because you kind of talk about your dual threats. The two biggest dual threats in the league are in the Empire roster and Ryan Osgar and Jack Williams, in my mind. Either of them can function as complete QB1s in the backfield or go downfield and dunk on your head. But then they're surrounded by, I think, three-ish of the more underrated handlers in the league in Elliot Chartok, Salman Ruschbeyer-Bailey, and the development of Oliver Chartok more and more alongside his brother. It just feels like New York has an ability to sort of fill in wherever they need to alongside the obvious talents of the 2022 league MVP and Osgar Williams, who is all but an MVP. And then I think last year it was really showed in the back half of the season, Elliot Chartok's deep throws add a dynamic quality to this team, especially when teams are so fearful of Osgar, who's, if you didn't see it in Daniel Cohen's article today or through extensive coverage over the last 3 seasons, Osgar is like by 2 deviation points the best deep thrower in this league, both in terms of volume and precision. He's top 3 in most hucks completed since the beginning of the 2021 season when this stat was being kept. He's also completing at near an 80% clip over that span, just absurd. And so now for Elliot Chartok to really grow into his own on this team and add his deep throwing ability alongside the rest of them, it just feels like New York has, once again, an abundance of riches in almost any position that they take with on the field. What do you see about New York's throwers that makes them so formidable? I know you were talking before about the receiving talent. Obviously, you mentioned Babbitt and Yacht. They had Lithio in years prior. He's now on Chicago. But there are some big targets. I still think this New York throwing team, or lineup, I should say, rotation, is what is the bread and butter of their attack. I mean, Salman Ruschbeyer-Bailey, much like Andrew Roy, is probably top 4 in terms of just guy I want as my stabilizing pivot handler. He just simply doesn't make mistakes. He's always mobile. He's always available. But anyways, I'm taking your time. What do you like about New York most?
I don't even think you mentioned Charles Weinberg.
He's upfield a little bit more. Terrific thrower, yeah, but they usually use him out of the back.
I'm not even faulting you for it.
I mean, Oliver Chartok,
I'm not faulting you for it. I think it's just like there's so many people you could name that it's like you can afford to leave that name off the list, you know? Like that's,
I mean, they put John Randolph on defense, but if you were to see him running offensive handler sets, no one would bat an eyelash, you know? I mean, he went to multiple national title games in his college career being the absolute QB1 of teams, so.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you mentioned Salman Ruschmeyer-Bailey. I remember being with Daryl Stanley and Ian Toner at Championship Weekend 2022 and just listening. I think it was Daryl that was talking about just like how when he was first put onto the O-line for New York, people were just kind of thinking, oh, this guy's going to be the weak link. Like, this is where you attack them. And it just turned out to not be that at all. And I remember at championship weekend specifically, he I don't think he made a mistake in their two games. Not that there were a lot of mistakes made by anyone on the Empire in those two games. They were so dominant, but he was so steady, and not just steady like a game manager, like he was making throws. Like, they're the hardest team in my mind. I mean, it's one of the reasons they've been so successful, right? Like, it's one of the reasons they're so hard to guard, because they have people on their offensive line that are just pound for pound as good at throwing the disc as anyone else, but they're also better athletes than their contemporaries. Like, if you were to put the top throwers out on a field together and ask them all to throw at targets, it would probably be similar results. But then afterwards, if you ask them to match up downfield, Jack Williams and Ryan Osgar are just going to beat everybody else. Like, they're just going to be better, because that's the thing. Like, we talked about, I think it was last year or maybe the year before, there were these articles coming out about like the different types of people that were like best in their roles in the UFA. And like, there was a hybrid section, right? And it was like Jack Williams, and people were very stupidly and very loudly trying to make the argument that, well, maybe like the reason Jack hasn't won an MVP, or maybe the reason he can go with the radar, is because he's not really as good at some of these things, because he's kind of too much of a hybrid. He doesn't have a specialty, which is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, that's like saying, I fail to even come up with something as dumb as that is, but I'm going to try. That would be like telling Kobe Bryant, as he became a better 3-point shooter kind of in the middle of his career, why are you trying to be a better 3-point shooter when you should just really focus on that mid-range jumper you got? Like, you don't need this 3-point shot. That's not going to help you. Like, no, like, become a great 3-point shooter. Like, that's the dumbest argument ever. Why would you not? If you can add that, why wouldn't you? And Jack Williams and Ryan Osgar, I mean, you could conceivably never have them in the backfield for the entire game, and they could beat you that way. Or you could have them only be in the backfield and never go upfield, and they could beat you that way. But why do that when what they can do so well is just kind of go in and out? And on any given point, they could spend more time in one space or more time in the other. And you're probably going to have a mismatch in some regard with whoever's guarding them, because as it stands, a lot of people feel more comfortable. You know, a lot of players, like, they have they want to either be guarding in the backfield or upfield, because those are different skill sets. Like, there are different things you have to kind of train your body to do. And you don't get a lot of reps against players where you're having to really worry about both at the same time, because those players that can be equally as effective in both spots at a high level, there's just not a ton of them. So when you have two of them on the line together, I mean, it's just so unfair. It's just so unfair for defenses.
And I think where it really becomes unfair, and one of the characteristics of the New York offense that I like so much over the past couple seasons, especially in the last two, as they've kind of cleaned up and refined some of their systems, their ability to create space, their ability to never really clump to necessitate being close to each other. New York stretches to the rails and kind of keeps the defense honest, obviously through the gravitational pull of their stars in one-on-one matchups. It feels like there's four players on their starting offense that require double teams at any given moment. That's an effect. But then New York strategically kind of pulls apart all of those elements, so the defense is stretched and unable to provide more help defense at different various structures in their coverage. And I think that Osgar and Jack's ability to sort of, again, keep them honest, keep the defense wondering, are they going to activate and burn me deep? Or when they do even just cycle and run a route into receiving space, that their defender can't either just call a switch or park in the handler lane, hoping somebody else has to like cover them downfield. They've got to go pursue that matchup. And so then you get a clear out of the space. You get someone else cycling back, maybe Weinberg or Oliver Chartok or somebody else comes back. Maybe Jack was upfield, Osgar interchanges, Jack rotates back. Like, New York's synchronicity and its ability to move those parts around is so much of their strength. And I wanted to also get back. You were talking about Ruschmeyer Bailey a few moments ago. You were correct. He didn't miss an entire throw on the weekend in 2022. He was 81 of 81 from the field. 8 hockey assists over 2 games and almost 600 throwing yards combined. Just one of the more impressive, I think, and underrated championship weekend performances of the last several seasons. And like you say, these weren't unaggressive throws that SRB was making. It felt very much like he was the incisive point of their attack at a lot of moments. He was setting up so much of their continuation looks to Lithgow and Osgar downfield. And yeah, he's just been a bread and butter addition to the New York offense as he stepped on this team in 2021.
Yeah, 0 turnovers, oftentimes better than some turnovers.
especially a championship weekend.
There's your nugget of wisdom from me for today.
Well, we'll, I'm sure, talk more and more about New York and their balanced throwing lineup, particularly as the roster continues to take shape. Again, we haven't heard any word about the re-signing of 2023 League MVP Jeff Babbitt, so that will obviously have a massive impact on the landscape. And yet we move forward and into our final team to discuss on this here episode of Top Throwing Rosters Hanging in the 2024 Season. And it is, like I said, not too long ago, last year's runner-ups from Salt Lake, the Shred. The Shred were second to DC in team completion rate last year. They were the top scoring team. They were second in red zone efficiency. Basically, any way you cut the cake, it looks like the Shred was one of the more impressive throwing rosters. And that's because I think both of their star power talent, as well as just the unit and its ability to develop in and of itself. I remember Bryce Merrill talked last year in an interview about how it felt like every player on the Shred offense got 10 to 15% better between the 2022 and 2023 seasons. And that really felt like their throwing in particular. I don't know if it was another year of familiarity, if it was the addition of Grant Lindsley and McKay Jorgensen that really provided more efficiency and I think speed and velocity to their attack. But just something really clicked last year where they went from being this sort of explosive but almost singular attack in 2022 that was so bound to the talents of Jordan Kerr's ability to shoot the disc into the end zone. He had 90 assists in that year, the second most ever in a single season. Whereas last year, it just felt like I had no problem with any number of their athletes pulling the trigger. I mean, even Jace Dunabile, who looked completely limited in his first professional season in this league in 2022, was a really dynamic continuation thrower from their last year. But I digress. Let's stick to their backfield. We've got Luke and McKay Jorgensen, Jacob Miller, Sean Canole, and then, of course, rotating in at times, Grant Lindsley and Jordan Kerr. Although a lot of times they won't really wait to activate in that backfield space until the team has moved more into the red zone. So for a lot of the beginning parts of drives, it's usually Miller, Canole, and one or both of the Jorgensens and McKay and Luke. What do you like about this team? I think for me, they resemble a lot of DC's ability to kind of take these longer drives, these big possessions from the back of the end zone, and move so swiftly into attacking position, as well as their ability to get the disc quickly into continuation looks, engaging good receivers in one-on-one coverage downfield, as well as sort of the ratchet play that they have between their handlers, quickly moving from sideline to sideline with the disc and really pushing and attacking the defense quickly, never really allowing the disc to settle on any element. Those are what stand out for me in Shred's offense and throwers. What stands out for you?
Yeah, for me, it's really like the speed that they have literally just like, they're one of the fastest teams in the league. Like when you watch them play, it just feels like they're playing at a different octane than everybody else. And I know that's like I would actually love to get a spreadsheet of just like 40 times across the league, because I have a feeling if we had something like that, that the Shred would be at the top, like of average 40 time of people on their roster. I think, like, for me, like, the ascension of where Jacob Miller got to last year,
He was like flawless in the first half of the season.
He was so good. I mean, he increased his completions by more than 100 and increased his completion percentage by 3 percentage points. And like, those are huge numbers to be. I mean, he added 33% extra load on himself from a throwing perspective last year. And that can easily really crush your completion numbers when you're increasing your load that much. It did quite the opposite for Jacob Miller. I mean, he was 98% completion percentage. And when you look across like the Jorgensens as well, Luke and McKay, I mean, they don't make mistakes. And I do think a big part of that is because they did tone down a little bit the deep throws. Instead, what they did, instead of throwing one 60-yard deep throw, like I felt like I saw a little bit more in 2022, what you saw were three 20-yard throws that took almost the same amount of time because they were just moving it with such pace. And, you know, that's just going to be a much higher completion percentage. It's going to lead to a lot smoother flow. You're getting more people involved in the offense as well, instead of running it through just a couple of people here and there. Jordan Kerr's assist numbers dropped dramatically compared to where they were before, but it wasn't because he was playing worse. It's just because the disc was being spread around more. And I think that was really the strength of them as an offense last year, was their ability to spread the disc kind of around to everybody. And everybody had the onus put on them that they needed to take the easy, quick pass. And for them, because they have such great athletes on offense and so much speed, a lot of times that pass presented itself very early in the stall count. If you can easily go watch some points where once they get a throw up field, you almost don't even know if the stall count started before they end up scoring on the other side of the field. So I think that's like their biggest team strength, was just knowing where to look for the continuation, and then being able to identify, analyze, and throw very quickly from the point of which they caught the disc. And I think they do that as well as anyone in the league. You talked about the fluidity that New York has, where they can kind of, it just feels like they flow so naturally, but they did have a slower tempo of offense. So that looks very
I'd different. Like to clarify, I think that they rotate positionally well. I don't find their disc movement to always be that quick. I think that they have such talented throwers again, and like Chartok and Osgar specifically on their deep balls, they can take a couple of seconds, let a route develop, and let rip. And I think that that is absolutely within their right to do so. Whereas Salt Lake feels like their decisiveness, it's just disc in, disc out, disc in, disc out. Like, they're almost like a pitching machine with the way that they can overturn the disc to the next player. It's like skip passing in basketball. It's just sort of touching out, touching out. I mean, even compared to DC, these are probably two of the more possession-heavy teams. DC has even not, they're just as fluid, but there's less almost like upfield aggression or speed or velocity or something to Salt Lake, because Salt Lake will just kind of blitz you. DC will take times to almost give flair. They'll sort of run circles around you and do reset patterns where you're just stuck having to play handler ball for 10 straight passes. Salt Lake has aspects of that, but they want to get upfield, man. Like, they'll do that for a throw or three, kind of move it around, but then it's Canole in power position ripping a 90-yard backhand on the fly to Kerr at a full sprint, right? Like, that's what the backfield motion sets up. They don't want to just sit back there. I think DC is a lot more content back there, whereas Salt Lake can play back there, but they want to get it up and out into continuation space, move upfield. They still, I think, possess that aggressiveness from their first season, even if it's not shown in their deep huck selection.
100%. The one area of growth for them that I'd be curious to see if they kind of can find this year is, what do they do when that quick game isn't
right
there?
And
we saw what happened at championship weekend. The quick game wasn't there because they were playing two very stout defenses. And while they were able to manage through it in the Minnesota game, clearly there were some issues in the New York Empire game in the championship. They did play them a lot tougher when they were at home in that regular season matchup. I will definitely be curious if Salt Lake can make it to championship weekend and meet New York there. what that game looks like this year. Like, I think what we saw in year two of the shred was it really looked like they took the losses to Colorado from 2022 and really tried to figure out how do we overcome Colorado. And then they did it. Like, now they were a pretty dominant team all year, but as we've mentioned before, their games with Colorado were tight. You know, one of the highlights of last year was that goal line block that sealed the win for Salt Lake, where they intercept the Jay Fruit pass right there on the goal line with no time left to win that game. And that was, you know, very momentous for them. But they obviously took what they learned in 2022, applied it to 2023. I will be really interested to see after a couple of games with New York last year, do they take what happened in those games? Can they take the lessons they learned there and apply those again? And like you said, Joe Merrill said they showed up, you know, 10 to 15% better. Can they go 10 to 15% better for a second year in the row? Because if they do, then they are legitimate threats to New York. We need to see that improvement, though, because clearly, I mean, from everyone last year, it was New York and the rest of the league. And as much as we see some close games throughout the regular season, once it gets to winning time in the playoffs, it just feels like there's an extra gear that only New York knows how to hit. But something tells me that Salt Lake, after recalibrating in the 2023 season, is going to do the same thing in 2024.
Yeah. No, and I think your point about their regular season tete-a-tete last year is really apt. It really felt like in the backstretch of that game, Salt Lake's offense had kind of figured out New York's league-best defense. I mean, Jay Stunabile had 10 scores in that game without a turnover. Career night for him, basically locked up his most improved award from the 2023 season. But Kerr had a solid game. Grant Lindsley, like, the offense was moving. And then you're right. Those championship weekend performances, I think, really illustrated how much Salt Lake struggles when they're not kind of in the driver's seat, able to dictate from that position of speed and, I think, throwing agility. So it'll be interesting to see if this year, if they can maybe find a few keys to how to get unstuck, to allow a bad performance not to totally derail them. And I know you're excited to see a championship weekend matchup, but we do get a regular season battle between New York and Salt Lake in a revenge game of last year's title game in week 10.
That's right.
That's June 29th. Will be featured as a super series game. So again, Salt Lake versus New York will come to you free and live later this season. But as much hype as we could continue to go on about the Super Series games, as well as the rest of the 2024 UFA regular season schedule and slate, that'll do it here and now for this episode of Swing Pass. Again, just 1 month till April 26th, the start of the new season. We will be getting hyped alongside you each and every step of the way as we draw closer to that date. Bid you adieu for now for myself and Cam. We'll be seeing you next week. Can't wait to talk to you then. Bye now.